I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Anne Filippi, founder of The New Health Club. If you want to know about psychedelics as new mental health tools, you came to the right place. I talk to innovators, thought leaders, and disruptors creating the future of mental health and mental wellness. And we think that the future is already here. Hi, guys, and welcome to a new episode of The New Health Club Show. My guest today is Cindy Gallup, or Lucinda Lee Gallup is her full name. And Cindy is quite something. I would say she is a real destigmatization pro. A genius if it comes to tell it like things are and then make them market ready. You guessed it, Cindy was an incredible advertiser, a female Don Draper, and we had many conversations over dinner about the rebranding of psychedelics. I wanted to have her on a show because she engaged on a psychedelic journey, not because of mental health reasons. She did it because of very simple curiosity and lust for life, which are also fair reasons to engage in a journey like that. Cindy studied English literature at Oxford, receiving an MA in English language and literature. She was an English advertising consultant, founder and former chair of the US branch of the advertising firm Bartle Bogle Hagerty. She worked on accounts like Coca-Cola, Ray-Ban, and Polaroid. In 2003, Cindy won the Advertising Woman of the Year Award from Advertising Women of New York. She's also the founder of the companies If We Run the World and of the company Make Love, Not Porn. According to TED, where she had her famous talk, Make Love, Not Porn, her talk was one of the most talked about presentations at the 2009 TED conference. She founded her own brand and business innovation consultancy, Cindy Gallup LLC, in 2006. And she recently, with 62, embarked on her first high dose of magic truffles. She says about herself to be boringly drug resistant. But after her experience, things, aka her life, changed. Cindy says, "What I did just reinforced for me was a sense of the history and the broadness of humanity and the importance in the future, looking into the void of finding light and connections," which is, if you know Cindy, a very different vocabulary that she is using than otherwise. So I can just say this was a very entertaining episode, also because Cindy is a great speaker and is always good to launch new thoughts and new ideas of the world, also about the world of psychedelics. Please enjoy the show with Cindy Gallup. Cindy Gallup, I'm super excited to have you on the show today. We once did a podcast a while ago, but before our psychedelic careers.
Yes, absolutely.
Everything has changed since then, but I mean, you're really a legend, one could say. You're a very specific person that doesn't exist often in our world. So, and I saw you, I think, a couple of years ago performing at the Tech Open Air in Berlin, talking about, I think already about Make Love, Not Porn. So, but first of all, I want to ask, since you just have done a couple of months ago your first high dose of psilocybin or psychedelic experience in that way, what has changed since then?
Sure. So I think what I'd like to do for the benefit of our listeners, and it's just contextualize this experience in a couple of ways. The first is that, you know, this was a particularly fascinating experience for me because I describe myself as boringly drug resistant. And what I mean by that is, you know, back in college, as we all did, I smoked a bit of weed. It had zero impact on me. So I, you know, didn't bother, you know, doing anything with it subsequently. I've tried edibles at various junctures over the years. They've never worked on me. You know, once took LSD, you know, didn't have any impact apart from some visual effects. So, you know, I am somebody who has therefore not had a lot of experience with altered states, you know, through any form of kind of, you know, artificial stimulant or whatever. And so this was an especially interesting experience for me in that context, you know. And then the second thing I'd say is, you know, I want to give you full credit for basically brokering the experience.
That's a nice word.
But also because, so, you know, how it came about really was back last fall when you were in town for Horizons.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. And you and I and our dear friend Susan Danziger were hanging out, you know, around her dining table. And, you know, and first of all, you know, you said to me, oh, there's a great party this Friday night, whenever it was, that you should come to, you know, and I thought, you know, gosh, well, I mean, I won't know anybody there apart from Anne, but you know, if Anne says it's going to be a great party, it's going to be a great party. So I'm totally showing up. So I went to the Palo Santo Ventures party. I think that's who was hosting it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And I have to tell you, Anne, that I have never been to an event, a party, where so many people came up to me and said, "Are you Cindy Gallup? I love Make Love Not Porn."
Oh, wow.
You know, literally. And I thought, oh my God, this is my tribe. Because clearly there's a massive overlap between psychedelics and, you know, sex positivity, basically. So so I was very struck by that. By the way, the party was wonderful. I had a whale of a time. But I was especially struck by the extraordinary number of people who recognized me, you know, knew Make Love Not Porn, thought it was wonderful. I was really blown away by that. So, you know, that really interested me in the psychedelic community generally.
It's a very specific world.
Yeah. And then, you know, you had originally recommended to Susan, you know, the concept of therapist managed journeys. And you recommended Hans and Janine of the Experiential Training Institute. And Susan told me that you'd said to her, if you're going to do this, you know, these guys are the best, you know, best in the game. And boy, oh boy, you were absolutely right. And here's another reason why this experience had a very profound effect on me. And because, so, you know, obviously, you know, the first thing Janine and Hans did via Zoom was, you know, do a screening call with me because they are rigorous in checking that you are mentally and physically, you know, in the right place, in the right state to undergo the journey. And so, you know, fortunately, I passed all of that. But I was very entertained by the fact that Janine and Hans were astonished that they were talking to somebody who has lived in New York for 25 years who has never been in therapy. So they went, what?
Unusual. It's unusual, yeah.
And, you know, and I'll come back to that fact because, you know, I'm a very fortunate person who has never been in therapy because I've had no need of it. And that's something the journey reinforced, and Hans and Janine reinforced. But it's precisely because I've never been in therapy that this experience gave me a glimpse of what brilliant therapy is like. And that was also revelatory to me. So this was, you know, as you know, this was an incredibly kind early birthday gift from our dear friend Susan, you know, which was a wonderful idea, as I say, inspired by you. And so, you know, we met up in Amsterdam last month, and Hans drove us out to this wonderful retreat place in the country. It was lovely being in the Dutch countryside, but also this place was gorgeous, you know, a lovely kind of house setting where we, you know, stayed and slept, and then a lovely yurt in the garden as well. And, you know, there were so many things that were fantastic about the experience, but you know, I think the things to highlight for our listeners, and anybody who, like me, is psilocybin curious rather than a veteran as you are.
I'm not a veteran. I started very late too. I mean.
Right, right.
Yeah, but I keep going. Yeah.
So, you know, because of how Janine and Hans managed the process, I just felt so safe, secure, and looked after at every point. You know, obviously part of what they do is throughout your journey, you know, you have one of them beside you. You know, Hans sat with Susan, Janine sat with me. We were in different places. I was in the yurt. Susan was in the house. But just, you know, the entire process was so thoughtful. And, you know, I just felt, you know, we had the best possible guides for it. And, you know, that extended from, again, you know, ahead of actually meeting up in the Netherlands, you know, a preparation call where, you know, they asked us to set our intentions. They gave us a very clear idea of what to expect, you know. I mean, what to expect in terms of the process, not the journey, because they said, you know, whatever you think you expect, it won't be. Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, just so our listeners know, I mean, I was very honest about the fact that I had no particular agenda beyond being extraordinarily curious. You know, I've been fascinated by Susan and her husband's experiences, you know, as I heard them. And so I was just very, very curious to go on this journey. But you do need to set an intention. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the thing that I'm most focused on at the moment is, as you know, I'm raising funding for Make Love Not Porn to scale. And so, you know, I'm saying this because all of this relates to what I actually experienced. And so I said, you know, I'm, you know, my single most important thing to me is that I'm able to scale my business and make it successful. And, you know, I'm feeling quite blocked on that front. And so I guess, you know, if there's any kind of intention I'm going to set, it's that, you know, I would love to get a different perspective on things, you know, a different way of looking at them to kind of unblock this process of taking my business to success. So that was the intention that I set.
Cool. Wow.
You know, so the whole process was 3 days. We had a day of preparation. We had a day of journeying and then a day of integration, you know, following the journey. And, you know, the preparation was terrific because Janine and Hans took us through a number of exercises, and I won't, you know, give details because if anyone's going to do this, they need to kind of go into it, you know, without going to encounter. But I was very impressed with, you know, the way that they prepared us. Then the actual day of the journey was interesting because, you know, first of all, as you know, you have to fast for 2 hours beforehand. We were going to have to, you know, start fasting from 7 o'clock in the morning because Janine and Hans are arriving at 9. And then equally they said, and the only thing you can eat before you start fasting is potatoes, because potatoes come from the ground as mushrooms come from the ground. The potatoes speak to the mushrooms, which I thought was a lovely idea.
Basically, yes. Yeah.
So Susan and I set our alarm at 6 a.m., got up and boiled potatoes, which were actually delicious with, you know, salt and.
With nothing, kind of, yeah.
Yep, with nothing. And then Janine had also said, do get some exercise because you're going to be lying, you know, indoors for quite a long time. So, you know, we did a brisk walk in the darkness of the Dutch countryside along the dikes, you know, trying not to get run over by cars on the road, got some fresh air. And then Janine and Hans turned up with the mushrooms or truffles, as they call them. And they said to us that they get their truffles from a man who breeds them specifically for, you know, various effects. And they said, what we've asked for is, you know, less focus on the visual part of the journey, but much more on the emotional manifestation in it.
Yes. Yeah.
And as it turned out, those were very good quality truffles. So then they had us grind them. We each had a little pestle and mortar and we ground them and kind of set our intention, you know. And then Janine basically made the psilocybin tea, infused, you know, them in flasks. And then Susan settled in the house and we went to the yurt and, you know, they had lovely comfy mattress laid out. You have eye mask, you know, lots of blankets. You're tucked in. You're very cozy. And you have the music playing. You have the soundtrack where as the music changes, then what you are experiencing, you know, will change as well. And again, you know, I love the fact that, you know, Janine Hans said to us, if you experience anything that unnerves you, you can just put a hand out. We'll hold it. We'll be there for you. When you don't want the hand any longer, you can just stop it. You know, they'd said to us, they talked about encountering what they call oysters. And they used the metaphor because an oyster is rough and ugly on the outside. And what they said was, you know, if you encounter anything that appears negative, frightening, don't avoid it, go towards it, because oysters have pearls. And actually within something that seems, you know, kind of threatening, mm-hmm. you know, there will be some gem that is an insight or something that you need to experience. So I drank the tea, you know, laid back, eye mask, you know, in line with my famous drug resistance. It took quite a long time to work. according to Janine, it took about an hour. Susan began, you know, to journeying about half an hour in. And the first thing I would say was that it was fascinating to me to have this state of consciousness where, you know, I knew all the time where I was. You know, I was lying in a yurt in broad daylight, you know, because under the eye mask, I could see a little bit of light. But at the same time, I was in some other space entirely. And so that to me was just fascinating. And, you know, I'm sure there's nothing more boring than listening to other people's psilocybin journeys. And I will just say that Susan's was especially interesting because she had some things that she really wanted to shed light on. And in that context, what she experienced was, I found fascinating. Mine was, you know, possibly less interesting, but the thing that characterized it was, you know all this, Anne, but for the benefit of our listeners, you know, it's taking effect when you start seeing fractals. You see kind of shapes, and those became three-dimensional shapes. And then for me, they resolved into a series of ancient ruins and historical landscapes. So I was looking at, you know how when you see places like Machu Picchu or Angkor Wat, we're looking at now are the mm-hmm. ruins, and then you see the outlines of the cities. You know, there's green grass, but then there are low stone walls. And so I was looking at a series of landscapes like that. And they began as being, you know, identifiably Indian, kind of temple ruins, historic buildings. They transitioned to East Asian. You know, at some point they were, you know, English country houses of the 18th century. So I cycled through a whole bunch of different landscapes. But the key thing that was the sort of defining point of my journey throughout was always whatever I was looking at, in front of me was an ever-changing series of faces. And these faces were, there was nobody I knew. I saw Susan once or twice later on in the journey, but they were faces of all, you know, genders, races, ethnicities, mixed in with some quite unpleasant faces. So there were, you know, those evil spirit masks that you have in Japan, China, you know, brightly painted, you know, devil horns, etc. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure.
And there were also faces of people who'd had violence inflicted on them. So the people with cut throats, you know, brains bashed in. But the great thing was that in none of this did I feel frightened or unnerved. I just went, ooh, that's not very nice, but it's going to change, because the faces kept, you know, changing. And that was the recurring motif all the way through. But what was interesting was, while I was looking at these historical landscapes, you know, I looked at these Indian ruined temples, and in a niche, I saw the Indian god Ganesh, the elephant god. You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Ganesh smiled and waved at me, okay, which is really nice. You know, and I'll come back to that because that was, I didn't realize the symbolism of that. Anyway, you know, again, because I don't want to bore our listeners, changing faces. And then, at one point, everything went black and very dark. And whoa, I went, wow. You know, then I thought, okay, you know, Janine Hans said, you know, oysters, you know, I thought, right, darkness, I embrace you. I go towards the blackness. You know, I'm going to find something in the blackness. And it took a while, but then I saw little points of light and I realized I was looking into the cosmic void in some form or other. And then the faces changed. They became Planet of the Apes, alien warriors, kind of, you know, there's a sci-fi element. Then I had a 2001 A Space Odyssey moment because I just saw the face of a giant baby. And And the baby kind of then dissolved, and I was still looking at blackness. And I knew by this stage I was coming out of the journey. And I thought, I don't want to end on blackness. You know, give me something more. And then I saw, you know, pinpricks of light. So I saw there was light in the void. And then I went, okay, right, you know, now I'm done. And it turned out that I had been journeying for 9 hours, which, as had Susan, we both, I mean, those were good quality troubles, you know, because I gathered the average length is only about 5 hours, you know, and so we both were journeying for 9 hours. And the integration day, again, was fascinating because Hans and Janine were terrific at bringing meaning, you know, and interpretation to all of this. And as I say, Susan's especially interesting. But just to kind of, you know, conclude with what was interesting. So, you know, when we were talking, and they have you kind of drawn right down in sketch pads immediately following when you wake up, you know, so you don't kind of lose any of it. And so I said, you know, I saw Ganesh, and Ganesh was smiling and waving at me. And Hans said to me, do you know what Ganesh is the god of? And I went, I don't actually, because I know he's a very important god in the Hindu pantheon. But, you know, now I think about it, I don't actually know what he represents. So Hans said, they'd had us draw cards from a deck. And Hans said, I drew a card myself yesterday, but now I realize the card was meant for you. And he showed me the card, and it was Ganesh. And Ganesh is the god of he is the clearer of obstacles. So he clears the way. And the interpretation of the card said something along the lines of, you know, you've been very frustrated. You've had all these blocks. There was a reason for that. If you had gotten what you wanted, it would have ended in failure. Now, all of the obstacles are cleared. You know, the path is clear ahead. You are absolutely going to, you know, achieve what you want to. And I went, wow. I mean, if I take one thing away from my journey, that is just fantastic in terms of, you know, what I want to do for and with Make Love Not Porn. And so for me, that was really interesting. But as I say, you know, Susan's experience was especially interesting because she had more enlightening things happening than I did. And Janine and Hans had also had us do a questionnaire ahead of this whole experience. And they showed us our scores on the integration day. And Janine said to me, Cindy, if you came to my office, as a therapist, I would kick you out because you have no need of therapy whatsoever, and show you my scores, and happy child and healthy adult were off the charts. And so fortunately, we reinforced the fact that, you know, I don't need therapy. But precisely because of that, I was so impressed with the therapy part of this as well.
But I mean, I think like that's a really interesting example with you because it also shows that it's not necessarily something in the future even more that people will do just because of therapy or trauma, which is sometimes coming up, but it doesn't have to basically. So, and can also give you like, let's say inspirations for your business or for you, you get ideas that you would never have otherwise. But I mean, my question, when I heard that you guys have done it, my first question was like, I want to ask Cindy if her relationship to love has changed.
Right. You know, do you know, Anne, I'll afterwards. Be perfectly frank, I was hoping for a lot more sex in my journey than actually transpired. And you know, the only moment that was something like that was, and actually when I saw this, I thought, oh, for God's sake, how cliche. But looking at those Indian ruins, on one wall were figures from the Kama Sutra.
So there you go.
And as I watched, they were all moving. They were all moving in their various sexual positions. You know, I did think, oh my God, that's so cliche for me. You know? But you know, I think what I would say, Anne, is, you know, I already, you know, I'm lucky to have started a business that is all about love. Because at Make Love Not Porn, we see nothing but love. We celebrate nothing but love. We are all about nothing but love. And by the way, as a startup founder, I feel very fortunate to have started a business that enables me to experience love every single day. And so, you know, I wouldn't say that my relationship to love changed. I think if anything, you know, what I was seeing over time. Oh, and by the way, when I talked about the faces, you know, Hans said to me, could those have been your past lives? And, you know, I hadn't thought of that at all. I went, wow, well, there were an awful lot of them. He said, the world is very old. You know, you've had a lot of past lives. So that's very interesting. My past and future lives, maybe with the sci-fi aspect of it, you know. But I think what it did just reinforce for me was, you know, a sense of, you know, the history and the broadness of humanity and, you know, the importance in the future, looking into the void, of finding light and connections. And I think that just kind of reinforces my philosophies anyway. But all of that just felt, you know, throughout the entire journey, I felt, as I say, completely safe. You know, I didn't encounter anything that I recoiled from or that unnerved me. And so, you know, that was all very reassuring in a way.
But I mean, you're half Chinese, half British, right? I mean, your mother is Chinese. So, and at one point, a lot of people, maybe in the trips to come, suddenly reconnect in a very interesting way with, let's say, the people or the countries, the nationalities they come from, not necessarily sometimes in a very direct way. It's like, oh, you're from here. You can see the German Alps or something. So, But was there anything that was striking you as reconnecting with your Chinese ancestors?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, Anne, because in amongst these faces that kept cycling through in front of me, there was one face that recurred several times, which was a Chinese-looking East Asian woman. And not a face I recognised, but because I was thinking also theoretically that this should be my mother, you know, but it wasn't my mother, you know. So I don't know who that was, but she was, you know, this Chinese woman. What was undoubtedly a recurring motif. You know, the other faces didn't recur, but this one woman, I did see several times.
And how did this make you feel? Did you have like a warmth for like an like a wish to open up to this, maybe also more to this culture?
I think because I very much embrace both halves of me, and I grew up in Asia and all of that. So I didn't in all of this, actually, I was just looking at everything with interest. You know, one thing Hans identified within the prep work was that, you know, I have a certain detachment to situations and that, you know, I am a classic Aquarian, you know, a lover of humanity in all the world, you know.
Me too.
Yeah. So you know the qualities of Aquarius, and so all of this was more me observing, you know, as interesting things played out before me. You know, it's interesting too because I did quite want to, you know, I found I had no agency in any of this because, you know, at one point I went, okay, you know, I'm seeing all these faces, you know, in different contexts. I think at this point I was seeing these faces as if they were engraven in ancient stone with desert dust sweeping across them. And so I did think, you know, okay, you know, I'm kind of bored with faces. I like to see something else. You know, come on, let's
show me something else.
Yeah. And I couldn't change that. You know, I had no agency at all in terms of kind of. I mean, obviously, as the music changed, things changed. But whatever I was looking at, there were always these faces in front of me. So I was, you know, I was kind of observing more than anything else.
But maybe it's also that you are somebody who's kind of working with people the best, maybe that, because I mean, obviously this is what your company is about. But of course, one thing I ask myself after preparing for this, because you're very outspoken that you have not been married, you not necessarily would like to be in a romantic relationship for.
Absolutely not.
Even with young guys, you kind of meet them on Tinder. And so, I mean, I'm just saying this because you're very outspoken about this too. And in Daily Mail, I was an article about you. So, and I was wondering, so did you get an idea about why you would actually, let's say, not wishing for a classic idea of romantic relationships? I'm just saying it a little bit more specific now. Or was it something that... Because I mean, what a lot of people experience in these trips is that they actually, for the first time, maybe after a long time in their lives, they reconnect to the feeling of love. It doesn't have to be for a specific person, just in general, which brings them then sometimes in coming back out of the trip to reconnect or redefine their love for maybe friends, partners, business partners. So has something happened for you in that context? I'm super curious because...
So the answer, to be perfectly frank, Anne, is no. And I think that's because you know, Janine said to me, and you know, I share this just because a lot of people make the same observation. She said to me that, you know, I was somebody who struck her as being extraordinarily in harmony with every part of myself. And I'm completely fine. You know, I've made my own choices, you know, over the course of 63 years, because, you know, but people say to me things like, you know, Cindy, how do you get this confident, you know, this comfortable with yourself? And I go, 63 years of life, you know, because that's what happens as you age. But, you know, I am very, very happy with the choices I've made. And just to explain to our listeners, you know, I'm that very rare person who does not want to be in love. And when you strip the desire to be in love out of your life, you strip so much bullshit out of it at the same time. And also, it's very time efficient. So, you know, I'll be reading a women's magazine, okay, and I'll come to the article about relationships. I go, not interested, boom, boom, boom. Okay. So when you never read anything to do with relationships and love, wow, that saves you so much time in your life. So, to be honest, and, you know, I was very comfortable with how I am going into this. I was equally comfortable coming out of it, and there weren't any revelations of that type. You know, if anything, you know, the exercise overall reinforced the fact that, you know, I've been lucky enough to have a, you know, stable, happy childhood. I wouldn't have described it like that myself, because with a Chinese mother, my childhood was characterized by extreme academic pressure. Tiger mother. Which is not great when you're a kid, to be frank. But, you know, in terms of kind of giving me the best possible foundation for a life, you know, my parents certainly did that. And so, you know, I didn't have any kind of holes to be filled, as it were, any sort of relationship to, you know, love that I think needed any kind of uncovering or, you know, so the answer, I'm afraid, is very boring. It's no.
No, it's just interesting. I mean, it's not boring, but I mean, do you feel that, because a lot of people, including myself, they talk about how their attachment styles have changed after psychedelics, not necessarily only around falling in love, but just being, for example, super open suddenly with people and don't feel like, oh God, my friend or whoever it is will certainly think I'm like totally crazy to open up about things. And I find often the longer I do this, that the less time it takes me to really say, tell people, well, this was really hard for me. This was really, this overwhelmed me in a way I never thought it would. So, and I think I would have done, it would have taken me like years before, even to close friends, to admit stuff like that. So, and I find it very relaxing to be able to not kind of dramatize everything like in this Carrie Bradshaw neurotics. So, and just say like, oh, well, I feel this way about it. I feel that way about it. Is this something that you experienced afterwards in your whole closer friend circle?
Oh, well, to be perfectly honest, Anne, as you know, I'm very open about everything. So,
yeah, but still, yeah. I mean, you also, it could be also, you know, you have your persona out there, and so you're very open, but it could be there's also a rather private Cindy that sometimes is not so.
No. No? No, I'm an open book. So again, the answer to your question is no, Anne, but I can totally see how that would work for people who need it. And I have to tell you, I mean, coming out of this experience, I'm recommending it to everyone I know. And I'm recommending it especially with Janine and Hans, because I just think, as you said, they are the people to do it with. But I can now absolutely see how it's an absolutely fascinating way of addressing things like what you're talking about, in a way that feels very organic, but because essentially it comes out of you. You know, what is manifesting is what is within you.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, you are enabled through psilocybin to, you know, find solutions yourself, find answers yourself for things that you need help with or healing or, you know, and so I think it's absolutely fascinating in that respect and highly recommended for anybody who, you know, would like to do something transformative that will set them, you know, on a different way of being and a different path and a different way of looking at themselves and things that they want to resolve.
Okay. And another thing I wanted to talk to you about is, I mean, when we met the first time, I think like 2019, we had the first conversation also at the same dinner table, like the one last time at Susan's, that it was still kind of obviously a problem around the stigmatization of psychedelics. And you are a master of destigmatization by yourself, like Julia Childs for cooking, basically you're for sex, if I can say that. And, and back then you said something very interesting, like that then would need to be another word for psychedelics. But now you feel like, I mean, I'm sure you've seen the John Oliver show on HBO that's going around. Like he really has this almost like 20 minutes or 10 minutes thing about the MDMA assisted therapy that's going to come on, like how psychedelics work, why they weren't allowed and scheduled. So do you feel in your context that is this destigmatization is making progress, or do you still feel there needs to be a completely new vocabulary around this?
So here's what's really interesting in response to your question, Anne. So I, as you know, I am very open about everything on social media. And in fact, you know, I recommend to people, you know, I'm just being myself on social media. And so I'm sharing everything, you know, from business things to, you know, what I'm doing with my friends, etc. So I wanted to share this experience publicly on social media. You know, first of all, I absolutely asked Susan's permission to do so, you know, asked if she would be comfortable, you know, because, you know, I wouldn't be able to share it without featuring her, you know, in it as well. And because she and her husband are investors in psychedelic ventures, you know, she was fine with that. She said, please just make sure that everyone knows it's legal in the Netherlands. So if you look at all my posts through the whole experience, I'm going, and here we are in legal in the Netherlands. Yeah. you know, I said that in every single post. So I decided to share, you know, this entire journey literally and the journey itself. And I've been blown away by the response from people because, I've shared this on LinkedIn, on Facebook, yep, on Twitter and on Instagram, you know, which are my four primary, you know, social channels. And first of all, you know, tons of people going, oh, wow, this is so interesting, you know, dying to know more. And then, you know, asking questions, you know, following along with me, absolutely fascinating. Plus, by the way, a number of people from the psychedelics community saying, you know, we're so glad that you are sharing this publicly and openly. I noticed I gained a ton of followers from, you know, psychedelic related, you know, businesses.
Very good.
and so I would say that, you know, I think we're at a point in time and where, you know, there is much more openness about many things, including, you know, what I'm focused on, which is openness about sex. You know, I think the time is absolutely ripe for psychedelics to come to the forefront in a much more, you know, destigmatized and mainstreamed way, as long as enough people are willing to be open publicly about their own experiences, their recommendations, because, you know, it's we who drive that openness, you know, people doing what I did. Because as I say, I was quite stunned by how very widespread and positive the response was and how much people are really interested and really curious. Now, you know, going back to the point you raised in your question, I do believe that it would be really helpful to find a different term for psychedelics. And the reason for that is because one of the quickest ways to make people think differently about something is to change the language around it. And the term psychedelics is so loaded with, you know, for people outside of the community, with, you know, decades of stereotyping around, you know, drugs and psychedelics, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I do still believe to your question that it would be great to find a different term, or even, you know, several different terms that are a way of talking about this area in an umbrella way, but without using the word psychedelic.
Do you have an idea what words?
What I need, Anne, is I need somebody with a psychedelics venture to hire me as a consultant to come up with that term. Pay me.
Yeah, it is.
I have 38 years of experience in advertising, brand building and marketing. So I am here for hire to help you reposition psychedelics in the psychedelics community and to find the vocabulary that destigmatizes and has it embraced within the mainstream.
Okay. This is going to be an interesting endeavor in the next couple of years. But I mean, you were, as you already said, you were kind of a very big advertising executive and started in the 80s, 70s, 80s.
Yep, that's right. And I began my advertising career in London in 1985. Yep.
I feel what's starting today is that people, not only women, men and women, are looking back at the early days of their careers or jobs in what industry whatsoever, and kind of start to realize what kind of traumatizing experience they have had. And sometimes this ends even in TV shows and Fleischmann is in Trouble, for example. Maybe you've seen that where
I thought it was brilliant, by the way. I was
it's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the woman, the writer, so it's obviously the writer from the show, she talks about her 20 years at something like GQ, where she always got told like, the next story is yours and it's going to be great. And then she never gets a story. And I mean, I had pretty much suddenly I was like, oh my God, it's exactly what I experienced at GQ. And, I wonder, so if those experiences from these early days in people's careers are actually have been traumas in a way that we start to realize what it has done to you. So
yeah,
how was your experience in these days with that kind of topic?
So what I'd say to that, Anne, is that I'm regularly asked in interviews, you know, so Cindy, what sexism did you encounter coming up the ranks in advertising? And my response is always, a fish does not know what water is. Because sexism and misogyny was all around me. But, you know, as a young woman advertising in the 80s, that was just the norm. That was the way it was. And you know, what I would say to your question, Anne, is so, you know, these days, as well as working as a consultant, a public speaker, I also do personal coaching. And I do personal coaching with men and women. But I have to tell you, honestly, through my personal coaching practice, I see all the time brilliant women whose careers have been stymied by men who are threatened by them. Okay, and it is just so depressing because, you know, every woman I coach is bloody brilliant. They are so impressive, but they have had their career path actively blocked, you know, actively derailed by sexist, misogynistic men. And also to your point about trauma, one of the things I have to say to the women I coach, you know, very often is you have to get out of where you are currently working. And the reason for that is, my English grandmother, you know, you referenced earlier the fact that I'm half English, half Chinese. So my English grandmother was an amazing woman, very influential on me in my childhood. And she was a Christian, but she was very interested in Buddhism. And so, you know, I remember from my childhood, you know, Buddhist sayings that my grandmother would regularly quote to us, me and my sisters. And there was one saying I particularly remember, which I've had occasion to quote to many, many women since. And the quote goes, you know, my grandmother used to say, the fool says evil cannot touch me, but drop by drop, the pitcher fills. And what I say to these women is, you think you can stick it out in this workplace, But I'm here to tell you that every one of those daily microaggressions, sorry, is that, that's a problem with it. Okay, right. Every one of those daily microaggressions, microsexisms, every day that is destroying a part of your soul, it's eroding your confidence. It is destroying your belief in what you are capable of. Get the fuck out. Okay. And so you're absolutely right, Anne. You know, all around the world, you know, in every country here in the US, in Germany, you know, there are brilliant women who are being kept down and often actively blocked and having their careers derailed by sexism and misogyny and racism and, you know, every intersectional ism in the workplace. And it's absolutely bloody appalling. And, you know, the good thing is that now we are all able to talk about this much more widely than we ever did before because of social media, because of the internet. And, you know, I'm very struck by the exceptional level of female solidarity on LinkedIn. You know, and incidentally, if you had told me 10 years ago that one day I would say to you, I'm all about LinkedIn, I would have laughed in your face. Okay, I am all about LinkedIn. LinkedIn is bloody brilliant because LinkedIn makes shit happen in all sorts of ways. And so that is also where female solidarity comes to the fore. You know, workplaces and this kind of sexism and bullying are outed much more. And that gives women more courage to go, it shouldn't be like this.
But I mean, just when you say the word shit happen, make shit happen, I just have to think about your kind of sales pitch. Like, I'm the Michael Bay of things or business. I blow shit up.
Oh, yep. Oh, yeah. For our listeners, my LinkedIn bio and all my social media is I like to blow shit up. I am the Michael Bay of business. And you know, fun fact, a friend of mine told me the other week that she was recently in a meeting with Michael Bay. And so she said to him, I've got this, and showed him my tagline, and he loved it. He thought it was hysterical. So at some point, I've got to meet Michael Bay.
But I mean, he's also somebody, if I can say this, I was once in a press conference with him and a couple of Hollywood actors, and he was extremely unpleasant, I have to say.
Yep. No. And I've heard all those stories as well. Yep. I mean, that's all I can say, right?
Yep. But I mean, I thought like, because in the beginning I didn't check who he was because the actors were in the focus point. Mm. So I always wondered, like, what could it mean that you pick him as the person who should be in your short introduction? Because I felt like between you and this guy, there's like worlds. But maybe that's the reason why I picked it.
So the way that tagline happened, Anne, was... many years ago, I was in a meeting with some potential consultancy clients, and I was explaining my consultancy approach to them. So I said to them, I consult very selectively only for clients and brands who want to change the game in their particular sector. So you come to me for radical, innovative, groundbreaking, transformative. I don't do status quo. And then, completely off the cuff, I said, lightheartedly, I like to blow shit up. I'm the Michael Bay of business. And everyone in the meeting laughed. And I walked out and I thought, actually, that's a really good way of summing up what I do. And so it's a joke, obviously. But my use of that tagline is not a bit of whimsy or a bit of creativity, a bit of fun. It's entirely deliberate because when I characterize what I do in that way, it attracts to me the people who want what I do. It repels the ones who don't. And I want to repel the ones who don't because they're a waste of time, effort, and money. I'm a big fan of be your own filter. I encourage everyone to do the same.
Okay. But I mean, coming back to the destigmatizing strategy. So, I mean, I remember there was also a time in journalism when people were like to destigmatize topics or to bring them up or to the surface. They would actually, let's say in talk shows, talk against let's say the rather conservative person who was anti-feminist, for example, or anti-psychedelics. So they would say, oh, what do you know? Kind of like being opponent to them. So, and now it seems that on LinkedIn, which I realize often there's a strategy coming where people, if somebody would write on your, let's say on your timeline, like, yeah, how can you do psychedelics? They're really bad for you, blah, blah, blah. They make you an addict. So instead of saying like, being opponent to this person, you would actually say, oh, I know where you're coming from. I knew also somebody that had a bad experience when I was a teenager. So And some people say that this would actually lead to a rather bigger destigmatization than just being heads on confronting the opposite. So what is a better strategy? What do you think?
Right. So first of all, in terms of that strategy, ain't nobody got time for that, Anne. Okay. I mean, by the way, all power to those who are doing it, but I would never recommend it. No, who's got time for that? Here's a different strategy. Okay. Because I'm going to give you the example of what I did, to destigmatize Make Love Not Porn and other sex aid adventures. And I did it very effectively, because it's a proven concept. So, this would have been something like nine years ago. Okay, I was trying to raise funding for Make Love Not Porn, and I was finding it enormously challenging because we are literally the final frontier of investment, you know. And so I deliberately, I'm a great believer in you know, building solutions to your own problems. Okay, I realized that I was going to have to pave my own way. I had to break down these barriers in my path if I wanted to scale Make Love Not Porn to be the billion-dollar venture that I know it can be. Because as I always say to entrepreneurs, when you have a truly world-changing startup, you have to change the world to fit it, not the other way around. And that is why in 2014, I deliberately got into what I like to describe as the Steve Jobs business of reality distortion. Because I basically went, if reality will not allow me to build my stuff the way I want to, I'm going to change reality. And what I mean by that is I deliberately began defining, pioneering and championing my own category, sex tech. So I literally wrote the definition of sex tech. If you Google sex tech, I'm result one on page one. Okay, I coined the hashtag, and by the way, sex tech is any form of technology or tech venture designed to innovate, disrupt, and enhance in any area of human sexuality and human sexual experience. That's the definition, which everyone uses now. I coined the hashtag sex tech. I didn't invent the term itself, by the way, but I am directly responsible for propagating the hashtag and the term as widely as it's now used today. And I began speaking at tech conferences all around the world on why the next big thing in tech is sex tech. Because I thought at base level, if I just say this loudly enough, often enough and in enough places, people will start to believe it. And I did this purely to legitimize my own startup. I did it to create a category that Make Love Not Porn could sit within that would drive more receptivity from investors. But today, sex tech is a thing. Sex tech is a known category. When you Google sex tech today, there are all these big data studies on it, which funnily enough feature me, but I can't afford to buy them, okay, as a bootstrapping entrepreneur. You know, and by the way, I'm widely acknowledged to be the OG of sex tech and the godmother of sex tech, as people put it. So, that's what I recommend to the psychedelics community. And by the way, again, I'm available to consult on this, but literally, you know, redefine psychedelics yourselves and do it in a way that then gets populist mainstream take up of what you decide that definition is. And there are, you know, again, you know, back in 2014, you know, nobody was talking about sex tech. So it's very easy for me to get to be result number one on page number one of Google. I wrote a piece for Hot Topics on what is sex tech and why is everybody ignoring it. And that is, you know, over the years, that is now the number one result when you Google sex tech.
Okay. But do you even think, I mean, like you see it in a John Oliver thing, like he goes back to the time when Nixon started to war on drugs. Like,
that's when everything went wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, of course it's important to know this, that it's the third wave of psychedelics. Like there has been research before, and then 5,000 years ago in a lot of cultures, religions used psychedelics to have a spiritual experience. So, but sometimes I wonder how it would be if you would just brand it as something that has just come out. So without a history attached. I'm just a question I'm asking myself.
And do you know, I love that idea. I love that idea. I think you're absolutely right. You know, in fact, funnily enough, That is what somebody was saying to me the other day about my Make Love Not Porn investor deck. Because in the deck, I talk about the fact that we've been operating for the past 10 years and we've used the 10 years to break down all the barriers. And this person said to me, honestly, what you have is such a brilliant idea. Forget the past 10 years. This idea could not be more relevant. I mean, obviously the relevance just increases, you know, and they said, just talk about it. You know, don't bother lingering on the past 10 years. Just talk about it now, because this is what the world needs. I think you're absolutely right. I love that idea.
I knew you would understand it.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, because I saw you in that show in the new Cara Delevingne show, Planet Sex or something, right? And it's a really, really good show. Because first of all, a supermodel is opening up about her irritation around gender and sex in a very interesting way, and attractive. And you can listen to her. Nothing is longer than a TikTok thing. So it's not too long. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
So suddenly you're a part of this show. And, so you basically, accelerate like a fast track. You're suddenly at Hulu. You're at with Cara Delevingne.
We've seen a real spike in traffic and members off the back of Planet Sex. Anytime we're in something mainstream, people want what we are: the documentary to porn's Hollywood movie. Absolutely.
Yeah, and so yeah. I mean, I think this is and in the show, like the way she talks about it. I mean, she has several topics around like, transgender or like the variety of gender. So they're like 6 or 7 episodes now, but I mean, everything feels in a way that it's something that has been just created now. So, and that makes it in a weird way attractive, because you sometimes don't have this, oh, there's a whole history and you have to go back to the ancient people, which doesn't mean that you shouldn't recognize that, you know, indigenous communities have done many things for thousands of years, and then just Western civilization kind of cut them off, cut their supply off for their spiritual experiences. But I think it could be a very revolutionary thing to say, have you heard of this MDMA that just came out last week?
And I think you're absolutely right. And to your point, this is not about in any way negating the history. You know, that will always be there in so many places. But the opportunity to mainstream comes with making people feel that there is this new solution to all sorts of things. I think you're absolutely right.
So if we have new kind of, let's say, possibilities to address things, I mean, like she does in her show, like the Fleischmann TV show with this woman saying, okay, 20 years of not being recognized in my career have made me actually numb and depressed, which has not been possible. I mean, when I was at GQ 5 years ago, not possible to even talk about this or to communicate this. So we have kind of problems emerging. So we need also new tools to work around these modern problems, so which can only be, in my perception, can be done with psychedelics very effectively.
Yeah, I completely concur.
If you would like to, like, let's say fast forward 10 years, so do you think, or do you feel that you have engaged now in a psychedelic journey that has just started?
Oh my God, yes. And no, I'm dying to do this again. Absolutely. Yeah, you bet.
But something else too.
I'm all in.
Now you're in your truffle phase, but do you look into other experiences?
Yep. I mean, I'm completely open to that. As I say, you know, in the past, I just haven't had anything be particularly effective. And so psilocybin has been fascinating in that context, because obviously it was something that absolutely, you know, had an impact on me. But I mean, I'm totally open to whatever the future brings in this context. Yeah.
Okay. So you, and do you actually engage, I'm sure you engage also in a little bit of integration afterwards, or you have like, I mean, like 6 to 6 weeks after, you still have this neuroplasticity where you suddenly connect dots, or like it reminds you of things that you've forgotten, right? I mean.
Well, I will tell you that, you know, when I got back to New York, I remember that many years ago, a friend had stopped by my apartment and he brought me a gift, which was a little brass statue of Ganesh. Oh. So right now, Ganesh is sitting on my table. I found Ganesh on my shelves, on my bookshelves. I brought him down to my table. He sits opposite my workstation. I've created a little altar. He's got a candle in front of him. I also discovered that somebody had given me some Palo Santo sticks, wood, you know. So I have one of those in a little tray because I thought, okay, right, let's clear the negative energy. Ganesh is the clearer of obstacles. So I've got one of those next to him. And my friend Martha Tara Lee, who's a Singapore-based sexologist, last year she incredibly kindly sent me this gift, which was two red Chinese Ung Pao packets with 10 million fake dollar notes in each of them, because I'm looking to raise just under $20 million. And so those are on either side of Ganesh. And so every morning I light the candle, I go, okay, Ganesh, clear those obstacles. So that's absolutely an impact that I'm now living with in my life daily after my journey.
So Ganesh is your business plan support.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. I mean,
yeah.
But I mean, it's interesting that people have these moments. I mean, I had one too, and in their trips that gave them information, sometimes not like, well, here's your information, but with symbols, with moments that brought them on a path that brought them success, but in a way that it allowed them to be maybe way more authentic in the end, that they, oh, I have to adjust to a business world that nobody ever knows anyway what that exactly is, kind of. And then one guy comes along and says, oh, fuck the business world. Yeah, exactly. It's again something else. So, but I mean, I feel like a lot of people, and I want to say women also, but men too, actually, but I talk to more women about this, I think. This sometimes the path clears in a way that they would not expect it to be cleared. People fall away, business partners fall away, industries, they leave industries behind. I mean, I left media behind because I didn't want to be there anymore in the way I was. So it's very interesting that it's almost that you can't almost prevent it. It's just going to happen to you after you've done this, which is great because you just have to say, okay, just keep going.
Yeah. Kind of. Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Anything else you want to put out there that you wanted to mention in terms of psychedelics that were very specific for you?
I just want to say that, you know, I am thrilled at, as I said earlier, the sex positivity that I've encountered within the psychedelics community. And obviously there is a massive crossover in terms of the use of psychedelics, in relationship, sex therapy, etc., you know, and so, you know, we are both working in utterly related fields, and I would just love to see, because I think part of mainstream and destigmatizing also is simultaneously mainstream and destigmatizing both of those areas by collaborating on them.
Well, I think also the most interesting thing coming out of this now between the sex and psychedelics connection, and we had Molly Malouf on a podcast and roughly addressed a couple of these things, these questions around the two topics. But I feel to me the most revolutionary thing is that obviously, a lot of women, if we talk about women now, and men too, again, have had a certain kind of sexual abuse, which obviously affected their sexuality in a much bigger way than they ever could think of. And I want to say it's roughly 50-60% of people, I guess, out there, which is kind of coming as it was mentioned in the study that it's much higher than we all think. And I find it super interesting how people who have experienced sexual trauma getting into a psychedelic therapy or experience, working around this trauma and basically redefining their sexuality afterwards. Not necessarily did they become gay or lesbian or trans, but just even if they stay in their, let's say, heterosexual, in this case, context, they suddenly start to find other people attractive, other attachment models attractive, even other nationalities sometimes attractive because it resonates more with them what they kind of like now or something. And this to me is something that is so interesting and is just beginning to come to the surface, that this is a possibility. I mean, which I have to say, I experienced this by myself. It's a complete transformation in terms of, relearning for yourself a healthy sexual behavior, actually.
And that is fantastic. I have to tell you, I mean, I was really blown away to find that at Make Love Not Porn, we hear from survivors of rape, sexual assault, sexual abuse. We hear from female, male, trans, non-binary survivors who tell us that our social sex videos help them reclaim their bodies. We have helped them feel able to be sexual again in a situation where porn is obviously way too triggering. And it's not just people who view our videos. Our contributors, our Make Love Not Porn stars, some of them have told us that sharing themselves sexually in a completely safe and trustworthy space has helped them process and heal from sexual trauma. So this is a use case that I never envisaged, by the way, when I designed this startup. So it's amazing to learn this. But you're right. This is so important. I think it's phenomenal that psychedelics can help with this. And I think it's what you say bears testament to something that I've been, you know, trying to get people to understand publicly for the past 14 years of Make Love Not Porn, which is because we're so messed up about sex, we default it to an act, to a thing we do. It's not, it's personality. Who we are sexually informs everything about how we feel about ourselves, other people, our relationships, our lives, our happiness. And, you know, destigmatizing sex means getting people to understand that when you are at ease with yourself as a sexual being, that is transformative in every single area of your life. And so I think this is, it's wonderful that psychedelics can help in this way. And that is absolutely a use case that needs to be made much more publicly known and mainstreamed as a way to, you know, treat trauma and, you know, everything that comes out of that.
Well, I think it's just starting to kind of being out there that this is one of the topics that is strongly connected in a way that I never grew up with the idea that there's a connection between how you behave as a sexual person and a traumatizing person. I mean, like I would say, I know about this now 3 years, so which is a very short time compared to when I started to, you know, engage in practices. So, I think it transforms the complete perception of porn, of what sexuality is, that even if touch can mean something already, not necessarily like the practices, like you said earlier, that we know from pornography, that it also includes like, I don't know, like the way you dress, the way you walk, the way you speak. I don't know, everything. So it's not this, oh, there's this sex that's happening there. And there it's not. So
yeah, no, exactly.
It's everything. It's a very interesting future we have ahead of us. So, all right. It was, of course, I knew it would be fantastic, but of course we could go on for hours. So great having you on the show.
I really enjoy this conversation. It's so important. And I do just want to say to our listeners, if I can say one final thing.
Sure. Yeah, of course.
If you like what I've talked about, please do support me and my startup. Go to makelovenotporn.tv, sign up, subscribe, consider becoming a Make Love Not Porn star. We have a revenue share model. I foresaw the creator economy 14 years ago. But also, you know, I am, as I said, I'm raising funding. So any investors out there, it's cindy@makelovenotporn.com. But also I'm very interested, as I said, in this crossover between psychedelics and sex positivity. And so I am totally available for consulting or speaking in this context. If anyone wants to contact me again, cindy@makelovenotporn.com. And I see our parallel paths of destigmatization as, you know, really intertwined. And the world will be a better place when we all mainstream what we're doing with no fear, shame, guilt, embarrassment around any of it.
Yeah, and once you start psychedelics, your shame is falling apart anyway. So. All right, thank you so much. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the New Health Club Show, and please follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or if you would like to sign up for our newsletter, please go to www.thenewhealthclub.de and subscribe to the newsletter. Again, please follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Clubhouse, of course. There's also a new health club now. Or even better, sign up to our newsletter on thenewhealthclub.de. I talk to you very soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.